I am William Knisley, and it's my privilege to be co-chairman of this colloquy. I would like to welcome you on behalf of the university and take the time immediately to thank the many students and staff who have contributed time, hard work, money, donations from students, and the friends off campus who have also supported the colloquy with both time and effort and funds. I will take a brief moment to talk about the next several lectures and then give some general remarks which I hope will relate to all of the colloquy, and then introduce the introducer of the speaker. The topic for these three lectures and the discussions and study this week is physiological aspects of human sexuality. A second lecture will follow today in this room at 7 o'clock by Dr. Neubart, and he will talk on observations of a practicing gynecologist. Tomorrow afternoon at this time, Dr. Gagnon will discuss sex, a cultural artifact. Next week, the topic will be cultural perspectives, and Drs. Driver, Labar, and Neubeck will present the three major addresses. The co-chairman with me in this colloquy is Reverend Donald Ward. For several years, he has been a member of the United Ministries in Higher Education. The colloquy was organized to partially fulfill identified areas of educational need, and Don Ward is responsible both for identifying some of the needs and bringing them to the attention of a number of us in the university, and also he is one of the many people who have worked very hard in organizing and presenting the colloquy. For some time, for some years, members of the Olin Health Center staff, members of the Counseling Center, and many university professors and others have brought up problems relating to sexual behavior. Problems that were appropriately being brought to their attention. As a student religious advisor, Reverend Ward talked, among others, with Dr. Hunt, Dean of the College of Human Medicine. And he talked about implied educational needs for some of the problems which were being brought to his attention. Dean Hunt suggested that he talk with me, and the problems that we discussed reinforced some previous concerns on my part that far too little of what is already known about the anatomical, physiological, psychological, social, and behavioral aspects of sexuality was being taught anywhere in our educational system. My criticism related to what I knew about education from kindergarten through high school, and including our schools and colleges, and including the professional schools for health professionals. As a professor of anatomy, it had seemed to me that we failed to teach medical, dental, nursing, and other health professional students much of the basic information about the reproductive system and human sexuality. We would not have left out similar data about the circulatory system, the nervous system, or the digestive system. It seemed that there was a tendency to carry over the general inhibitions about these topics, even into those educational programs in professional schools where skills in health matters implied the need for such knowledge. Informal discussions followed among deans, directors, members of the student health staff, and others, and they confirmed similar concerns on the parts of other staff at Michigan State. These led to formal meetings in which it was agreed that there should be a general discussion of human sexuality to be widely available to members of the university community, and with the hope and expectation that it would provide information and initiative for the incorporation of more relevant materials into ongoing and perhaps new courses. The timeliness of our concern has been documented by similar presentations at other institutions, including one at Wayne State last summer, and by other events. One such event was the passage in 1968 of significant changes in the law governing the presentation of information on sexuality within the public school system of Michigan. The previous law limited presentation of sex information to doctors and nurses, and the previous law even excluded specifically discussion of several topics by them. The new Public Act, number 44 of 1968, is a marked social advance, and its legislative sponsors and supporters are to be applauded. It is worth reading several parts because they are excellent statements of our purposes in planning this colloquy. Section 789A states, "Any school district may engage competent instructors to provide facilities and equipment for instruction in sex education, including emotional, physical, psychological, physiological, hygienic, economic, and social aspects of family life and sexual relations, as well as socially deviant sexual behavior. The Department of Education shall, according to the next section, section 789B, the Department of Education shall, A, aid in the establishment of educational programs designed to provide students in elementary and secondary schools, institutions of higher education, and adult education, wholesome and comprehensive education and instruction in sex education. B, establish a library of motion pictures, tapes, literature, and other education materials concerning sex education available to school districts authorized to receive the materials under rules of the department. C, aid in the establishment of educational programs within colleges and universities of the state and in-service programs for instruction of teachers and related personnel to enable them to conduct effectively classes in sex education. D, recommend and provide leadership for sex education instruction established by the local district, including guidelines for family planning information." Now, I add for we older and younger people who criticize all legislatures that I think that this is a significant contribution to social welfare by our legislature this past summer. Sexuality is a fundamental aspect of living beings, and it is a part of the basis for classification or taxonomy. In the 1700s and early 1800s, as biologists tried to classify all plants and animals which they found, several times groups of individuals were identified as a species, only to discover later that sufficient differences between visible characteristics of males and females had resulted in their classification as two separate species of a single species. These errors were viewed with some humor, since at the same time an important part of the definition of species had developed, namely the inclusion of the concept of the ability to interbreed and produce fertile offspring. It would appear from the advertising business, where it is assumed that direct or even tangential illusions about sex can sell anything, that there is an interest in this topic. We hope that as direct discussion as possible here will result in better understanding of ourselves and of each other. And I would settle for less gullibility and susceptibility to such advertising as an indicator of success in this educational endeavor. It is appropriate to attempt some continuity also in the first week of this quarter with the end of the fall quarter of 1968. Father Hesburgh, president of the University of Notre Dame, stated in his convocation address in December that too many adults have forgotten how to love and too many youth have forgotten how to laugh. It is to be hoped that both of these can be assisted through this colloquy. I would end this general introduction by reading the two additional sections of the excellent 1968 Michigan Education Act, because they so well summarize both our intent and hopes and also our concerns about this colloquy. The beginning section, 789, states, "Sex education is the preparation for personal relationships between the sexes by providing appropriate educational opportunities designed to help the individual develop understanding, acceptance, respect, and trust for himself and others. Sex education includes the knowledge of physical, emotional, and social growth and maturation and understanding of the individual needs. It involves an examination of man's and woman's roles in society, how they relate and react to supplement each other, the responsibilities of each towards the other throughout life, and the development of responsible use of human sexuality as a positive and creative force." The last section states, "Any student, upon the written request of parent or guardian, shall be excused from attending classes in which the subject of sex education is under discussion, and no penalties as to credits or graduation shall result therefrom." While I would hope that no parent ever finds it appropriate to request the exclusion of his child from an informed discussion on sex information, I concur in the inclusion of this escape clause because all opinions must be respected. Thus, this final section of the Act reminds me that all of us, consciously or subconsciously, take into account the time and the place of given actions when judging them. And though acceptable times and places for given behavior are changing rapidly, we must continue to recognize that differing and even conflicting opinions from our own are also valid ones. It's a privilege to thank again all of the students and staff and the friends of the university who have participated. Introducing today's speaker is Dr. John Kneller, professor of physiology and of animal husbandry at Michigan State University. Dr. Kneller received his bachelor's and doctorate degrees from the University of California. He studied comparative physiology at the Davis campus. He came to Michigan State University in 1955 and has carried out numerous experiments involving the comparative reproductive physiology among a number of species, including large farm animals and small laboratory animals. He has been largely responsible for the building of a significant comparative reproductive physiology laboratory here, and his investigations have resulted in such interesting and important results as the beginning development of effective artificial insemination in swine, a process which, when effective, can markedly increase the protein supply for human beings. Dr. Kneller has been a consultant of the National Science Foundation for a number of years, and 2 years ago he aided in founding the Society for the Study of Reproduction, an international group which will be holding a meeting here at Michigan State University on the 16th and 17th of this month. He is chairman of the education committee of that society, and appropriate announcements of the meetings on the 16th and 17th will be made. Work by men like Dr. Kneller and Dr. Mites, also in the physiology department here, has helped in our beginning to find out such interesting things as the precise cells in the base of the brain in the hypothalamus, which produce given defined chemicals, which bring about the miraculous secondary changes of adolescence. This knowledge is an important biological base for understanding the still far more complex social, sexual behavior of human beings. Michigan State University is fortunate in having Dr. Neller on its staff, and it's a privilege to introduce him for the introduction of today's speaker. Thank you again.
Thank you, Dr. Knisley. To proper introduce our speaker, I would like to assume a role which I do have a part in, and that is a member of a national society for the study of reproduction, and more particularly as a member of an education committee. All national societies have education committees. We are fortunate in the area of reproduction in being involved in what you might call the most critical issues of our time, the productivity of the sea or reproduction for food, the productivity of land animals for our food, the conservation of our wild species as our heritage, and certainly the need for a greater understanding on population control. Members of our society, which include people from human and veterinary obstetrics and gynecology, behavioral biology, large and small, and many other areas of more exotic research in unusual animals, have at one time or another been imposed upon to give a birds and bees talk, or even participate in a structured course in sexual education. Our educational committee, however, made a survey and were rather surprised to find that there is really no standardization of teaching sexual education, even in our medical schools, certainly not to our college students, and it becomes quite diverse when you consider the public themselves. Of more interest is the variety of talent that they draw upon to approach this very important topic. For most part, this is assumed by the already overburdened clergy or medical practitioner, but for most part, it is undertaken by specialists in very specific areas who have no real sensitivity to the many factors that affect the sexual expression. That is, the economic, sociological, theological, biological, and psychological impingements upon this natural function. Being as we are so completely surrounded by sex, I noticed the other day it's even invading the cereal box advertisements that my children enjoy. We must assume that this is the carrying out of some sort of a national plot, or at least a national educational policy, or if not that, an educational policy at the state level. I can assure you that there is no national policy on sex education. In fact, when you consider the Office of Education in Washington, they do not wish to discuss this with you. They are at the whims of the legislature for their support, and until there is considerable public enthusiasm and some sort of a well-tried format, they are not willing to endorse any standard policy towards sex education. The majority of the states have not given legislative approval to a comprehensive educational program. Dr. Knisley mentioned that we are certainly in the front on this in the state of Michigan. However, even if you have legislative approval, you must start somewhere. Sex education is indeed an educational function. Michigan State University has assumed what I consider a very exciting role in the comprehensive sex education. Certainly the inclusion of a modern sex education very early in our medical school program is one step. The participation, the all-college participation in the colloquia on sexuality represents the extension to all branches of our college. And now, this series which you're enjoying today, the start of it, the public series represent an involvement of all individuals in this very critical and personal problem. Well, we might say, why sex education? Who needs it? We all know about it, so why make such a point of it? Our guest today, Dr. Leslie McCary, is admirably suited to discuss this topic with us. He is a graduate of North Texas State and the University of Houston, and received his doctorate degree from the University of Texas. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Houston. That is, he is indeed an educator. He is a recognized researcher in clinical psychology, as evidenced by his many publications in scientific journals. He is a practicing clinical psychologist. He is also where the action is. He has published several books on the physiology and psychology of sexual behavior, and his most recent book, Human Sexuality, is recognized as a most comprehensive coverage of this very difficult subject. Dr. McCary is a fellow of the American Psychological Association, the American Association of Marriage Counselors, and the American Academy of Psychotherapists. We're certainly pleased to welcome you here today, Dr. McCary, to start the first of our series of public lectures on the physiology and psychology of human behavior, but more specifically, why sex education. Dr. McCary.
Thank you very much. It's certainly a great pleasure to be here at this university in this rather monumental and outstanding program that you people are presenting. I've been asked to concentrate my remarks today on the current efforts to understand the psychophysiological interdependence in human sexuality. I'm assuming that this interdependence refers to the effects that psychological and environmental factors can have on sexual functioning, and vice versa. Understanding the human reproductive systems, people's plumbing, if you want a more succinct term, is certainly a simple matter. The failure to comprehend sexual anatomy and functioning, then, can only be attributed to the many sexual emotional hang-ups that afflict us. And as the inescapable results of the centuries of misinformation, guilt, shame, and mystery that have shrouded the subject of sex, we have indeed become uncomfortably sensitized to the very word itself. It is my firm belief, and most scientific evidence supports my contention, that the vast majority of problems we encounter in human sexual behavior would not exist if we did not have a disturbed attitude and emotional reaction toward sex. You will hear me say this many times today. Our sexual behavior is related to our sexual attitudes. These attitudes are, in turn, a direct result of the sex education we have received, or the lack of it, and of the misinformation that we carry into our sexual relationships. For this reason, I wish to direct most of my allotted time today and my remaining energy to the subject of sex education and the crucial necessity of improving it. To say it another way, why are we so fouled up sexually? In Lawrence Lipton's recent book, The Erotic Revolution, he states, "The old sex ways, the traditional morality of monogamous marriage, are in an advanced state of decay and are losing ground with dizzying rapidity, and that the new morality is made up of office wives, swap clubs, and uninhibited teenage sex. We are told that there are signs of a sex revolution all around us, that in large cities, homosexuality has become open and obvious and appears to be on the increase, that the dam of censorship has burst and books are now published and sold openly, which would have horrified our grandparents. The recent book, Sex and the College Girl, implies that virginity among college girls is almost non-existent. Such books tell us these things, but without a shred of truth. Furthermore, they are designed and written to prey upon the repressed, guilt-ridden emotions surrounding sexual drives and desires, and of course, to capture a fair share of the American dollar. For example, in Sex and the College Girl, the author's interviews ranged and averaged at least 6 girls on each of 102 campuses. Even the author has no way of knowing whether or not these girls are truly representative of their classmates. Since the beginning of recorded history, older generations have been in a state of shock and horror at the immorality and other unacceptable behavior of younger generations. It is not surprising, then, that newspaper and magazine articles, organized groups, and individuals are crying out that the nation is on the brink of ruin because of the sexual misconduct of its young people, whom they view as a decadent, sexually loose, amoral bunch who are riding toward hell on a motorcycle. There are, to be sure, those incidents that incite public outrage and that are offered as evidence of general moral degeneration among the young. But there have always been such occurrences, and there are no more now, if as many, than there were in the past. About 2,400 years ago, Socrates wrote, quote, "Children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders and love chatter in place of exercise. Children are now tyrants, not the servants of their household," end quote. Scientific evidence, which is free of emotional biases, makes it overwhelmingly clear that the young people of today are as well-adjusted mentally, as mature in their responsibilities, and as decent a group of citizens as America has ever known. Much has been written in recent years about the sexual revolution that is allegedly taking place. And while research findings and clinical judgments are not wholly consistent, the general consensus is that there has been no revolution of any significance since the 1920s, when those women born around the turn of the century came of age and set new sexual standards. About that time, around 1920, there was a significant increase in the incidence of premarital sexual intercourse. The percentage jumped from 14% among women born before 1900 to 36% among those born after 1900. Parenthetically, I might mention that this change in incidence of premarital sexual intercourse occurred at the same time that women gained so-called equality with men in the economic and political arenas. There was another circumstance that might also have been a contributing factor, although the relationship is only suspect and not proven. It was about 1920 that a safe and satisfactory contraceptive device, the present-day vulcanized condom, became available. Sociological and psychological investigations indicate that very few changes are occurring in the sexual mores of boys and girls of today, although, as one expects of members of any new generation, they are working out new standards of thinking, believing, and behaving. Kinsey found in 1948-1953 that between the ages of 16 and 20 years, 17% to 19% of the college girls were having premarital sex. By the age 23, the percentage had risen to 30%. Incidentally, these figures are lower than those for the same age groups which had only grade school or high school education. In 1959, Dr. Winston Ehrman studied 1,000 students at a large state university and found that considerable petting was occurring in boy-girl relationships, but only 1 out of 7 girls, or about 15%, were not virgins, as compared with 2 out of 3 boys who were not virgins. In 1965, Dr. Marvin Friedman and Dr. Nevitt Sanford concluded from their separate large-scale studies that there is no decline in student morality. Both investigations showed that 3/4 of the unmarried girls were virgins, and of those who were not, by far the majority restricted premarital sex to their future husbands. Only 2 to 3% were promiscuous. In a recent preview of the new Kinsey report, Dr. Gagne will talk with you about this, I'm sure, tomorrow. The researchers found few differences between the sexual attitudes and behavior of today's young men and women and those sexual attitudes and behavior on which they reported 25 years earlier. Americans in general are not having sex relations at an earlier age than before, although the age differences between the boy and girl at the time of first sexual intercourse is somewhat smaller. The neophyte sexual partners now tend to be more nearly the same age. There is a bit more permissiveness on the part of girls in petting, and the male is now somewhat more likely to have an emotional involvement with his sexual partner, even though still, by and large, his first sexual experience is still with a casual pickup. Today, there is less tendency on the part of the male to exploit the girl in a sexual relationship. Furthermore, both sexes enter into the relationship with the attitude that sex is fun, rather than so much with the traumatic, guilt-ridden feelings so predominant in past generations. This change has been particularly apparent among the females. Furthermore, there is no evidence that the pill has increased sexual acting out. Promiscuity is not rampant among college students, and there has been no great leap forward in coital permissiveness since the change in sexual behavioral patterns that occurred in the 1920s. There is, on the other hand, a great amount of evidence that today's young people, especially the college population, are behaving responsibly. Indeed, they demonstrate considerable moral strength in their concern for the welfare and rights of others. There will always be rebellious youths whose behavior will outrage certain segments of the citizenry, and such outrage has a tendency to radiate to include all youths in the thinking of many adults. But every new generation has contained a core of rebellion, and the only surprise is that today there are not more rebellious acts, and certainly there are no more than in past generations. As a matter of fact, group rebellion has often forced some of our most needed social reforms, although when such insurgence begins, it is interpreted by many simply as further evidence of the failure of adults to maintain proper control of their charges. While in my opinion, there is no sex revolution at the present time, there is more and more evidence that revolt looms on the horizon. One can hardly have escaped noticing a change in sexual attitudes in recent years, as evidenced by the growing freedom with which sexual topics are discussed in the various communication media, schools, synagogues, churches, and governmental circles, as well as at cocktail parties and by the man on the street. But attitudes and the ease of discussing them are not to be confused with behavior. Even those to whom a decision in the matter of sexual ethic is most pertinent, today's college students, are bewildered and bedeviled by the dichotomy between prevailing sexual attitudes and sexual behavior. For example, although 75% of college girls express the belief that their classmates are sleeping around, which is an attitude, surveys and research studies consistently point out that actually only 20% of all college girls experience premarital sexual intercourse, which is behavior. As mentioned earlier, our sexual behavior is essentially the result of our attitudes towards sex, and these attitudes in turn are the product of the sort of sex education we have received. And sex education begins with the first intimate mother-infant contacts. Instruction in sexual matters, however, involves infinitely more than the interrelationships between parents and child. Significant roles are played by many other influences. They are not only the general demands and expectations of the specific culture in which the person lives, but also the special differences in sexual ethics within that culture. Differences based on such variables as the individuals, as well as the teachers, type of religious affiliation and depth of involvement, sex, age, educational level, and socioeconomic stratum. And since we are concerned about changes in sexual morality and sexual behavior, and since changes in behavior results from prevailing attitudes, we should investigate some of the present-day attitudes towards sex. It should probably be underlined at the outset of any discussion of this nature that significant changes in human mores, behavior, laws, and social institutions occur only gradually. Especially slow are changes in culturally acceptable sexual behavior, because the orientation and experiences of childhood place strong limitations on the frequency, form, and freedom of such behavior in adulthood. With unfortunate ease, sexual attitudes can fall under the pall of such cultural maladies and misinformations as misinformation and prudery. For example, women of emancipated modern societies frequently are troubled with menstrual difficulties of one sort or another. Yet, Margaret Mead's anthropological studies of women of Samoa show that when they were questioned, only one woman of the entire population even understood what was meant by pain or emotional imbalance during menstruation, and that particular girl was in the employ of the island's white missionary family. Most of our sexual problems have similar emotionally disturbed antecedents. All people to a degree, but Americans most particularly, it would appear, are inclined to cling to their traditional ways of thinking and conducting themselves, whether in politics, religion, or whether it's sexual matters. They are reluctant to accept change or to be swayed by outside influences, however rational or beneficial. This rather blind adherence to tradition is found not only in major cultures, but within specific subcultures as well. Probably the greatest social change to occur in recent years has been the emergence of women into a position of equality in American society. The freedom and parity that women demanded and now enjoy in the United States have had a profound effect upon prevailing sexual attitudes. According to the traditional American attitude, women were presumed to have characteristically different sexual needs and drives. And a woman, having little amatory interest in sex, participated in copulatory activity only for the purpose of procreation or to please her husband. Most women today are unwilling to accept the notion that each sex is subject to different standards in the matter of sexual desires and conduct. They expect the pleasure received from sexual activities, as well as the restrictions governing them, to be equally applicable to both sexes. It is interesting to speculate on why more restrictions in sexual matters are placed on women than men, and why women are the ones on whose shoulders we place the responsibility for controlling sexual behavior of both men and women. It's not too difficult to see where some of our muddled and contradictory thinking along these lines got its start, for one need look no further than at the patriarchal customs of biblical days to see at least part of the source. Hardly had life begun, as related in the Bible, before we find man putting the responsibility for sexual morals on the shoulders of the woman. In chapter 2 of Genesis, God told Adam to avoid fruit from the tree of knowledge, and by chapter 3, Adam and Eve had already fouled up, and Eve was the fall guy. Besides being kicked out of their biblical supermarket, the Garden of Eden, they had to wear clothes of pelts, and Eve was assigned to have birth pains and to submit to her husband. From this crummy beginning, the girls have been fighting for equality. Skip on to chapter 19 of Genesis, where Lot offered to swap his two virgin daughters to the men of Sodom if the men wouldn't demand homosexual relations with his guests. You remember that God intervened to make everything all right, and that when Lot's family was leaving the sinful city, Mrs. Lot looked back on the destruction of the city, and you know what happened to her, instant salt. Later, Lot and his daughters lived in a cave, wherein these girls gave Lot some juice of the grape and got him drunk and had sex relations with him and had children. I don't remember how many, but very likely the Lots begot a lot. Anyway, the important thing is, who was to blame? The daughters, of course, because they planned the act and got Papa drunk so that he wouldn't know what he was doing. Now, you can't tell me that this is not just another way to make the woman assume the blame for the sexual acts. Because if Lot was so drunk that he didn't know what he was doing, the chances are he couldn't do it. In this case, In this case, at least, because male sexual functioning just doesn't work that way. An interesting side effect of this struggle for equality is that the sexual attitudes of American women are often considerably healthier than those of American men. Chroniclers of sexual histories, whether researchers or clinicians, have found that women are far more open and honest in supplying their personal data than men are. Men frequently become embroiled in the question of self-esteem and may attempt to compensate for what they feel is a threat to their self-image by boasting, with the consequence that the data they provide are often unreliable. Despite the recent liberalizing evolution in the realm of women's rights, certain differences between the sexual attitudes of the two sexes continue to be forged by such factors as childhood rearing, the expectations of society, and certain physiological agents. Premarital chastity, particularly for girls, is still considered an ideal, even though, as Thomas Poffenberger says, society no longer takes the pious position that all premarital coitus is evil and that the offender should be punished. The most significant deterrents to premarital sexual activity are religious and moral codes that condemn it, family training, various fears, a desire to wait until marriage, the lack of opportunity, and the lack of desire. Fear of pregnancy was a strong deterrent in the past, but it is no longer regarded as a prime factor in premarital continence. Other changes in sexual attitudes have their basis in the protracted period of adolescence that shifts in the American social structure have imposed upon its youths. The imposition of additional educational and vocational requirements has made necessary an extended adolescence. Yet the age of a youngster's physical maturation comes considerably earlier than it did in previous generations. Because of these two considerations, the period of social adolescence is now approximately twice as long as it was 100 years ago. During this prolonged period of youth, the two sexes begin to develop different attitudes toward premarital sexual activity. The natural feelings of insecurity which adolescence breeds and the increase in physical drive, especially in the boys, make the adolescent particularly susceptible to the hawkings of Madison Avenue when it extols the supreme value of sex appeal in striving toward popularity, success, admiration, security, and the like. Boys are propagandized through the various mass communication media to believe that their masculinity, that is, their success as a man, depends upon their success in seduction. The further they go with girls sexually, the more masculine they are in their own eyes and from the viewpoint of their peer group. Girls, on the other hand, are indoctrinated in the importance of being sexy. They are exhorted to purchase an often ludicrous and useless conglomerate of products that, according to the advertisements, are guaranteed to increase sexual attractiveness. A young girl is indeed in a delicate position. She must appear and act sexy in order to attract as many boys and to have as many dates as possible, because these are the symbols in her all-important peer group of popularity and social success. At the same time, however, she must hold the line of propriety, because otherwise she risks losing her good girl status with the consequent loss of prestige. Girls too often are favorably evaluated by their peer group only in correlation with their popularity in dating and the number of boys whom they cause to make open, affectionate commitments, coupled with their ability to remain free of sexual involvement. As boys and girls grow older, they come to adopt a more permissive sexual code of behavior. This doubtless is due in part to the fact that the younger teenagers submit uncritically to the traditional sexual ethic of their parents. But as they grow older and think more and more independently of their parents, they come to a progressively greater extent under the influence of outside values, particularly those of their peer groups. Let me remind you again, however, that even with recent relaxations in sexual codes, changes in teenage sexual behavior have been in the direction of increased petting rather than of increased coition. An example of the often curious difference between attitude and behavior lies in the fact that many people in our culture, especially men, have difficulty entering into warm, close, loving interchanges with others. Little boys are often taught that to be tender and compassionate is to show characteristics of being a sissy. Little girls are admonished that it is forward to be warmly responsive. To grow up in an environment that restricts positive emotional responses makes it likely that the individual will learn to express only negative emotions, such as anger and hostility. All the same, these people grow into adulthood with the abstract knowledge that some warm emotional exchanges are vital and expected in successful sexual interactions. But since they learn from their formative years to express only negative emotional responses, these people will actually instigate quarrels or fights with their sexual partner in order to express the only type of emotionality they understand. Men who have never learned how to express tenderness or who are afraid to do so will often ignore the woman with whom they are sexually involved or make belittling remarks to her. These men want to demonstrate their commitment, but not knowing how to use the appropriate positive emotions, they use the only emotional expressions they are familiar with, the negative ones. A further conflict in sexual attitudes is expressed by adolescent as well as adult males in what has been called the princess prostitute syndrome. That is, the good girls don't, the bad girls do attitude of some males. This attitude impels them toward intercourse with girls whom they do not care for, since they consider girls whom they respect too good to become involved in sexual activity. However, because of their fondness for the good girls and their developing emotional closeness to them, the boys may become sexually aroused. As a more intimate relationship grows, sexual behavior may well progress in some cases to sexual intercourse. As a result, the young boy often loses respect for the good girl, who in his eyes now has turned bad, pardon me, and he may quite likely terminate the relationship, or he may develop strong guilt feelings for seducing a good girl. A sad byproduct of an overemphasis of the good girls don't, bad girls do training is that men frequently find this concept carrying over into their marriages, with the results that they are unable to function sexually with the good girls they marry. To involve his princess in freely expressed, enjoyable sexual activity would, in essence, make her a bad girl. Furthermore, who are the good girls in these men's early lives? Their mothers and sisters. And it follows that sex with a good girl, even in marriage, would smack of incest. These same poor men might well be able to perform quite adequately with prostitutes or some other women for whom they have little respect or admiration, that is, the bad girls. Clinicians have presented convincing arguments that many men are beset with considerably more guilt over sexual matters than women are. Their premise is that women in non-marital sex relationships especially, usually and understandably, want reassurance that they are desired and respected for more than their sexual performance. Women want assurance that their men will not kiss and tell, and that they will maintain the same level of regard for them after sexual intercourse as before. A man, on the other hand, feels that as the instigator of the sex act, he is the seducer, and that the responsibility for the girl's participation rests squarely on his shoulders. To placate his own guilt or anxiety, therefore, he must either feel that there is love in the relationship or that the girl is bad. Furthermore, since he feels guilty about his seduction of the girl, he comes to regard her as the instigator of his guilt. He is then impelled to express his hostility and anger by quarreling or fighting with her, speaking to her in a degrading manner, or otherwise manifesting his rejection of her, the very girl who thought enough of him to share with him the most intimate of human experiences. Fortunately, both men and women can be taught to allow themselves the joy of experiencing close, warm, and loving relationships. If they have not acquired this knowledge through normal maturational processes or through experience and observations, Psychotherapy can help them gain insight into the immense value of manifestations of affection. When men and women recognize that free expression of affection is certainly nothing to fear, nor a barometer of weakness or effeminacy, all their human relationships, including the sexual one, will be much fuller and happier. In the matter of men showing affection, it might be mentioned at this juncture that women often accuse their husbands of showing affection toward them only when they have intercourse in mind. Husbands deny this. What often happens is that the husband commences simply to show affection to his wife with no ulterior motive in mind. However, in the process of expressing affection, especially if the wife responds warmly, the husband may well become sexually excited. The wife then judges only in terms of the final outcome and not the initial intent of her husband. Girls in their mid-teens begin to recognize that, in our society, the male is supposed to be strong and confident and to offer security to his female. Not having the insight, tutelage, or experience to evaluate what constitutes genuine strength on the part of boy or man, and furthermore feeling inadequate herself, the girl actually does not know what to look for by way of indicators of masculine strength, and may come to accept certain warped manifestations as qualities of manliness. These are the girls who are often impressed by the tough guys, the hellraiser who is defiant of rules and of the society that makes them, the leather-jacketed thug on his motorcycle, the school dropout committed to tobacco, alcohol, and profanity, and to little else in life, the dragster who is as reckless of human life as he is of human sensibilities. These girls have no way of assessing such behavioral patterns as being attempts by the boys to mask the marked feelings of inferiority that overwhelm and threaten them. The very thing, therefore, that a young girl wishes to avoid, inadequacy and weakness in a man, are what she is unwittingly courting when she looks to the tough guy as an ideal. An unfortunate byproduct of this twisted set of values is that the nice boy who attempts to treat such a girl with kindness and honesty, but who has no need to prove his adequacy by the unacceptable acting out behavior described above, is too often ignored, if not regarded with downright contempt by her. Other factors enter into the emotional complexities of these girls. As mentioned earlier, they are crossing the threshold into physical maturity and feel inadequate to cope with their social and sexual problems that this new role poses. Since many girls evaluate themselves as rather worthless and insufficient beings, the boys who behave decently and compassionately toward them cannot, they reason, have very good judgment. Or if the boys offer their friendship so unselfishly, they must not be of much value themselves. It follows, according to these girls' rationale, that the boys who callously ignore or mistreat them are exhibiting good judgment and are therefore the obvious strong masculine ones, the social or sexual worthies. Furthermore, these girls have normal sexual desires and wishes, but frequently feel guilty about them. And it ensues in their thinking that in our society, guilt demands punishment. Therefore, by selecting one of the tough guys, such a girl is able not only to satisfy her sexual desires, but at the same time to assure her punishment, because unconsciously or otherwise, she realizes that sooner or later she will be mistreated or rejected by this unsavory boy. It is, incidentally, a widely recognized phenomenon among psychotherapists and marriage counselors that many women marry problem men, for example, alcoholics, because they have an unconscious need to be punished. These, then, are some of the attitudes which form the foundation of our present and future sexual behavior. It should be apparent to each of us that many of our rigid, outmoded, unrealistic, and guilt-laden attitudes must be changed. It should be equally apparent that the responsibility for these changes rests squarely on the shoulders of the parents and other decent citizens of the community who are in a position to teach and to mold new ways of thinking and behaving among young people today. It strikes me, however, that so long as we older people maintain some of our own neurotic and self-defeating behavior, we are not likely to get very far in compelling young people to listen to what we have to say. Why should a youngster believe an adult about the dangers of, say, smoking marijuana, when the same adult smokes cigarettes from a package clearly labeled, "Caution, cigarette smoking may be hazardous to your health"? And the additional admonition that to smoke marijuana is illegal while smoking tobacco is not, will quite likely be ignored. Youth is simply not thoroughly convinced of the value of laws because of the parent's defiance of them. For instance, when the parent drives 50 miles per hour in a 40 mile per hour zone. The fact that there is little traffic does not change the existence of the law any more than does the fact that many authorities question the actual danger or hazards to health of marijuana. Despite our own shortcomings, it is still our responsibility to give guidance to young people and to try to bring more consistency into our own preachments and behavior. And as been said before, we know that sexual behavior clearly is the result of sexual attitudes, and that sexual attitudes clearly are the result of the sort of sex education to which people have been exposed. The transition then from unrealistic, guilt-infused sexual attitudes rests solely on the quality of sex education we give our young people. And to afford them proper education in this realm may well require a process of re-education on the part of the adult population. But this is a good thing too, because it is never too late for any of us, and might in fact open new vistas of fulfillment and satisfaction. In a recent survey, high school honor students criticized their parents most for having failed to discuss with them the subject of human sexuality. 2/3 of these students had never been told anything about sex by their parents. The others had received only cursory information, and that was faulty and garbled. Information about sex, frequently erroneous and steeped in negative emotionalism, is most often received from young people's peer group, usually through the medium of bad jokes, and secondarily from their parents. Very little comes from public schools and similar institutions. Most of those who learn the basic facts of their sexuality learn them too late to help them through the initial period of sexual adjustment. For example, in another survey, about 2/3 of the boys who were told about sexual intercourse by their parents already knew about it, and perhaps half of them had already experienced it. And about 70% of women canvassed in still another study reported that they had been led to believe, and chiefly by their mothers, that sex was dirty. Why this distressing situation is so common is quite simple. Parents are filled with shame and guilt about sex and are themselves painfully uncertain in what they genuinely believe about sexuality and sexual behavior. They are reluctant to admit to this confusion, and they often have little valid information on the subject. Rectifying this state of affairs is, however, not a simple matter. One might readily ask how young people can be trained in a healthy attitude towards sex when the adult society in which they live is unable to reach a consensus on sexual matters. If agreement, for instance, cannot be reached on the moral right of married adults to have free access to contraceptive information or to engage in whatever kinds of sexual activity they wish in the privacy of their bedroom, how can agreement on a moral or legal code of sexual behavior for the young and unmarried be expected? It is indeed unfortunate, but nonetheless true, that today there is no clearly accepted or acceptable code of sexual beliefs and behavior in our society. Adults will have to resolve their own illogical and guilt-ridden sexual attitudes before the young in their charge can become educated rather than indoctrinated. Until such time, perplexity and irrationality in the sexual sphere are liable to be perpetuated from one generation to another. Laymen and scientists alike too often are strangely reluctant to accept scientific findings or even to give unbiased examination to new data in the field of human sexuality. When new investigations appear to lend support to time-honored prejudices, They are quickly accepted as being scientifically impeccable. However, when contemporary research fails to confirm cherished theories, the research tends to be discounted as suspect, its conclusions judged as being quite likely distorted by sample and examiner bias. Such suspicious attitudes have been seen in certain public reactions to the recent work of the Kinsey investigators into the work of Masters and Johnson on the subject of human sexual response. The Kinsey workers were especially harassed. As Kinsey commented in his first book, quote, "During the first year or two, we were repeatedly warned of the dangers involved in the undertaking and were threatened with specific trouble. There was some organized opposition, chiefly from a particular medical group. There were attempts by the medical association in one city to bring suit on the ground that we were practicing medicine without a license, police interference in two or three cities, investigations by a sheriff in one rural area, and attempts to persuade the university administration to stop the study or to prevent the publication of the results or to dismiss the senior author from his university connection or to establish a censorship over all publication emanating from the study," end quote. The many approaches to an ethical sex education range from advocating the avoidance of sexual experiences altogether to openly approving complete sexual freedom. At one extreme is the ostrich-like position that there should not be any sex education. A problem not faced squarely, it is hoped, will quietly disappear. Sexual conflicts, unhappy marriages, premarital pregnancies, abortions, and a general anxiety in sexual matters are all sad testimonials to the fallacy of this premise. Next on the continuum of sex education theories is the thou shalt not approach, which treats sexuality as a gift from God that is to be used solely for the purpose of procreation. Judged from this viewpoint, sexuality used for any other reason becomes immoral, animalistic, and defiling. The thou shalt not approach, however, obviously denies the basic fact that man's biological sex drive will, one way or another, find expression. It is thus less than realistic and probably produces more conflict than the total ignorance imposed by the first theory. It is not an exaggeration to suggest that the guilt-ridden moralistic patients crowding the offices of marriage counselors and psychotherapists have largely been molded by the thou shalt not philosophy of sex education. The next approach on the continuum is that the fledgling should be inundated with facts. Sex is hereby stripped entirely of its veil of seclusiveness and sanctity and is presented in an unembellished fashion without any suggestions of its emotional content. According to this approach, since sex is a physical drive, it should be discussed in terms of physiological data and in a straightforward manner, omitting any psychological considerations or emotional overtones. What this approach ignores is the incontestable fact that sexual activity is far more meaningful when it takes place between people who love or at least admire one another than it is, say, in masturbation or when love or affection is absent. At the far end of this continuum is a viewpoint which might be called sexual anarchy. This theory of sex education urges the removal of all blocks to sexual freedom and would grant unrestrained license to any act that individual sexual needs and desires might dictate, the only qualification being that no hurt or injury befall others. Such permissiveness, of course, challenges the value of virginity and monogamy, as well as the other popularly approved sexual conditions. This precept implies that sexual activity should be regarded as fun and uninhibited by shame, guilt, tradition, or any code of morality. To a degree, such a permissive sexual ethic has much to commend it, because so many of our taboos are senseless and act only to inhibit emotional growth, development, and happiness. However, man does not pass his days in isolation from his fellow man, and he cannot therefore expect to defy openly and consistently the mores of society, especially those of such emotionally laden content, without encountering society's wrath. Since most of us are influenced, willingly or not, directly or indirectly, consciously or unconsciously, by our associates, it is wiser to conduct ourselves in a manner that is fairly closely related to expected patterns of behavior, at least insofar as others know. Otherwise, we shall find ourselves reprimanded, rejected, or even jailed with a painful backwash of sociological and psychological problems. The safest solution to this dilemma would appear to be a course of compromise and selectiveness among the various philosophies of sex education. Certainly, sexual needs should be permitted expression. Unadorned information about the physiological and psychological aspects of sex should be presented to all. And the Judeo-Christian traditions within which we live must be understood and dealt with sensibly in the framework of present-day society. Relative freedom of expression in sexual matters is justified because of individual differences in sexual preferences. Emotional and personality factors should be considered in striving for greatest sexual satisfaction and happiness. There are few absolutes in this world, and only bigots establish an inflexible code of sexual morality based solely on the rightness or wrongness of the commission or omission of a specific sexual act. Generally speaking, the consequence of a certain act upon society is a far better criterion for judging its morality. To expect healthy males and females to avoid or to inhibit all expressions of their sexual needs and drives is unrealistic, to say the least. It is true that different cultures and subcultures permit varied means of expressing sexuality, and hardly any group fails to recognize that the need is present and that it will be expressed. It is well recognized that if these sexual needs are not expressed in one way, then they will in another. Thus, by denying healthy expressions of the sexual impulses, we are in reality encouraging its expression through the guise of psychoses, neuroses, personality maladjustments, guilt, inadequacy feelings, psychophysiological sexual difficulties, and true sexual perversions. In the last part of the 19th century, a physician wrote in a medical journal that he did not believe that one bride in 100 married with the expectation of sexual gratification. What direction the expression of the denied sexual impulses took is a question the physician failed to consider, or at least to answer. Much of a normal person's behavior is influenced by the inhibition of sexual impulses and the displacement of the expression of these impulses into other channels. For example, we consciously are disturbed by the thought of premarital or extramarital sexual relationships. Yet, we show our unconscious interest in and perhaps desire for these very acts by joking about them or otherwise showing excessive interest. Consider how many of us laugh at or express horror over the less than conventional behavior of certain luminaries in the entertainment world, yet voraciously follow every detail, however exaggerated, of their activity. We thereby satisfy our own desires, conscious or unconscious, by identifying with these people, yet at the same time, by pointing the accusing finger at them, we avoid self-guilt. The attentions accrued from a denial of our desires are thus drained off through joking and laughter. Certainly, this is not to say that control and appropriate expressions of our sexual needs, according to time and place, are not desirable or necessary. But to set up unrealistic and unreasonable prohibitions, whether directly or through the mechanism of guilt, is setting the stage for trouble now or later. In his 2-volume survey of contemporary American attitudes on sex, love, marriage, and family relations, that is, the folklore of sex and the American sexual tragedy, Albert Ellis, who is going to be one of your speakers later in the term, made a painstaking examination of stories, advertisements, books, magazines, newspapers, movies, and other mass communication media. He concluded, or his conclusion was, that our woefully inadequate sex education, with the resulting neurotic repression and inhibition of normal expression, has had a greatly deleterious effect on our lives and behavior. There is little doubt that our guilt, shame, and unrealistic demands and expectations in the realm of sex cause our distorted approach to and interest in this normal human need. Pictures of near nudes on paperback books, the burgeoning sales of girly magazines, the use of attractive women with seductive voices and voluptuous figures as modern-day hucksters to sell everything from shoe polish to salad dressing, the suggestive adult-only ads for many films. All of these point out the manner in which our mishandled sexual drives are being expressed. We allow this display of sexual force to pervade almost every aspect of our lives. In a recent incident, the only way a department store owner in Birmingham, England, could quell the indignation of window shoppers inspecting his negligee-clad mannequins was to put wedding rings on the mannequin's fingers. This sort of prudery has been matched in America by the Society for Indecency to Naked Animals, which has fought to protect children from the sight of naked animals, particularly cattle, dogs, and cats. The Society, SENA, advocates the clothing of animals, at least if they appear in public or in the presence of children. And while SENA started out as a hoax, many American do-gooders were quick in their attempts to join the Society. Several thousand wrote to the organization, so-called organization, within the first 2 weeks. A current slogan states, "Movies are better than ever." Why? Because films, according to their advertisements, contain more bedroom scenes and more snide sexual innuendos than ever. If an enterprising producer were to make a motion picture of Little Red Riding Hood and wanted to assure its financial success, he need only to designate it as an adult movie with no children's tickets to be sold. Now, mind you, this does not mean no tickets will be sold to children, just no children's tickets. After all, children are fair prey of this game also. The advertisements might well portray Miss Hood as a buxom candy, being almost but not quite seduced by a lustful bare-chested human wolf. The woodchopper, axe in hand, would be prominently displayed in the ads for those who like aggression tinged with sadism in their sexual fantasies. It follows that grandmother is shown languishing on her queen-size bed, dressed in a flimsy nightgown, her expression suggestive more of longing and sexual deprivation than of illness. The sad conclusion to be drawn from all these particulars is that our thinking in sexual matters has become warped by the residuals of guilt, ignorance, and inappropriate means of contending with aggressive and erotic urges. It is not that the questionable advertisements, fictions, illustrations, and the like in our mass communication media have a strong effect upon our aggressive and sexual behavior. To the contrary, they merely mirror our sexual anxieties. Too often parents rely on the supposition that if their children do not know about sex, they will avoid it and will consequently lead a sexually unblemished life. Nothing could be further from the truth. For example, parents will frequently withhold information on contraceptive and venereal diseases, and they will recount only the dangers and the shames of illegitimate pregnancy and VD, expecting these approaches to keep their children from engaging in premarital coitus. Yet the findings of the Kinsey Group disclosed that only 44% of the unmarried women interviewed listed fear of pregnancy, and this was long before the pill, as a deterrent to sexual intercourse, and only 14% listed fear of venereal disease as a deterrent. Before the modern swiftly effective cures for venereal diseases were available, and when these social diseases were greatly feared, people nonetheless readily engaged in sexual relations even with partners whose freedom from infection was not determined. Investigating the correlation between fear of VD and its incidence, one study recently showed that of psychologically normal men who had no fear of venereal infection, 15.4% contracted one of the diseases. Of those who had a higher and moderate fear, the percentage actually rose to 20.8%. And of those who had a very strong fear, 15.3% became infected. A recent study of unmarried pregnant girls showed that they had received little or no sex education either from home or school, and that their mothers either lacked proper sex knowledge themselves or were unable or unwilling to give proper instructions to their daughters. And one recent study on follow-up pregnancies showed that sex education will decrease repeated pregnancies in unmarried girls by about 80%. It by no means follows, on the other hand, that a girl having adequate knowledge of contraceptive devices is an assurance that she will use one of them if and when she has premarital sexual intercourse. The evidence is to the contrary. Many girls reasoned that contraception is the boy's responsibility, and that if they took it upon themselves to ensure that some contraceptive method were available, it would appear that they were both overly willing for coitus and premeditated in their behavior. Well, contraception should apparently become somebody's business, inasmuch as one in six brides in America is pregnant when she marries. Curiously, many of these unwanted pregnancies occur among the religiously devout who, despite their determination to refrain from sin, somehow lose control of their emotions and get swept into the act of sexual intercourse. The World Health Organization states that ignorance, not knowledge, of sexual matters is the cause of sexual misadventure. The clinical experience of most psychotherapists and marriage counselors certainly lends support to this viewpoint, as does the subsequent strife and heartbreak of parents and their children who become victims of sexual misadventure. That parents possess little enough accurate information on sex may be true, but what they do have should be shared in an open and honest manner with their children, even though their own guilt and confusion in the area often make this a most difficult task. The important thing, nevertheless, is their openness with their children on this most crucial subject. For parents who do not have accurate or adequate information, or who are actually afraid or ashamed to talk with their children on the subject of sex, there are books, physicians, psychologists, and various agencies from which the children, and the parents for that matter, can get a sex education with a minimum of emotional stress. Even here, however, there is danger of unwittingly selecting an emotionally oriented, factually unscientific book or a counselor who has his own problems. It is unfortunately true that except for an adequate knowledge of reproductive processes, physicians as a group are grievously ignorant and actually rather prudish in matters of human sexuality. Furthermore, it has been established that because of training of ministers in marriage counseling is grossly inadequate, and because they are lamentably uninformed or plainly misinformed, only 15% of such counseling service can be considered competent. The impact on marriage of adequate early sex information can be judged from Clifford Kirkpatrick's analysis of the components of sexual marital adjustment. The subjects of his survey ranked adequate sex information in childhood third in importance among the leading 10 factors considered fundamental to a successful marriage, falling behind only happiness of parents' marriage and adequate length of acquaintanceship, courtship, and engagement. Marital happiness depends to an important degree upon the sexual adjustment, and sexual adjustment depends upon proper sex education. For example, certain physiological anomalies have been found to be related to sex education and to emotions. Most women who suffer from premenstrual tension and difficult menstruation have a background of parental discord and sex education from a mother who presented it in a deprecating manner. Many other scientifically controlled studies point clearly to the fact that sexual adjustment and satisfaction are directly correlated with emotional stability and maturity and with having received an adequate sex education. My own conclusions, arrived at after 20 years in the classroom among young people and as a clinical psychologist, are that indeed we do need a new sex morality, one based on sense rather than mindless prejudice, on compassion rather than rigidity. And my feeling is that we will never achieve proper sexual stability and mental health, undisputed requirements for maturity, until we have instigated and persevered with a sound sex education for everyone. And since the sex education is not and apparently cannot properly be given in home or in the church, it has to be given in the schools, like it or not. This goal means that those of us who are in a position to instruct must freely admit to what we do not know, at the same time seeking, accepting, and teaching that which we know to be the truth, no matter how far it deviates from our own expectations and personal needs. We must educate, not indoctrinate, teach facts, not fallacies, be objective, not subjective, be democratic, not autocratic, aid the young in formulating a code of ethics, and avoid passing on to them our own irrelevant, guilt-producing, emotionally biased opinions. This will be difficult because most people have grown up in a culture which produces and espouses most or all of the negative agents in sexual ignorance and maladjustment. Richard Starnes in the New York World Telegram and Sun sums up this problem fairly well with his comment that never in the history has a nation talked so much about prudery from a basically horizontal position. But despite these difficulties, we can and must correct these problems if we are to grow and mature in a healthy manner. The sex education movement has barely begun, but great strides can be made, and rapidly, if we push aside public apathy, resolve to overcome public resistance, and assume those responsibilities which are so clearly ours. Thank you.